We're speaking with Peter Leonard, principal conductor and interim artistic director of Opera on the James. And we had you last time we were together, I think it was in November. Can you tell us what's been going on since then?
Oh, we have been busy.
I'll bet.
We've had, in November, we were talking about our Festival American Opera, which went just great.
Great.
It was really reaching out into the whole community. Since then, we've been really busy. We've become partners with the gorgeous new historic theater and the Academy Center of the Arts in Lynchburg in a fantastic project that is new for our area. Of course, other people know about it because the Metropolitan Opera is doing broadcasts around the country. And we are partners in the presentation of those right in Lynchburg in the historic theater. And our part is actually to provide a pre-talk, an introduction to the coming up show, just 1 hour right in the theater, no extra cost for ticket holders, just 1 hour before the performance. And I just did the first one. It was such a thrill to stand on the stage of that beautiful theater. We had a great time. Lots of people didn't know about it yet because we've just put it into motion, but we have it set up really casually where the theater opens, of course, a little before, an hour before the performance, in this case at 1 o'clock. And I start the speech around 1 o'clock and go until maybe 15 minutes or 10 minutes before the actual screening, which starts at 2 o'clock. And if somebody comes a little later, they're welcome to just, you know, come on in and take a seat. Wherever they like. We do have reserved seats for those performances. So once in a while, somebody's sitting in a reserved seat where someone would like to have the seat right now, and so you just slide over. It's very much fun. And when we talk about opera together, it really isn't, you know, like a boring, stuffy lecture. It's much more, I always say to the visitors, this is a conversation. So if you have questions or comments, you know, just raise your hand. If you don't like what I'm, you know, what if you think it's boring what I'm talking about, just close your eyes and yawn a little, and I'll go on to another subject. So it's pretty freewheeling. And the subject, of course, is the opera at hand. But I do not tell the story of the opera. That's something you can look up anywhere. And, of course, because now in the broadcast there are subtitles. You can read the translation of every word that's being sung, regardless of the language. What we talk about is background. We talk about the kinds of things that I know about as, you know, as an insider. In this case, there was a piece where the story of the opera happens in a theater. So there's actually a stage within a stage. So I talked a lot about the way that Baroque theater was and how different it was from our understanding of theater and a live show.
Now, this past, I believe it was February 17th, you gave the pre-talk for Carmen. Can you give us a little bit about what that was like?
When we talk about Carmen, no, I can't talk. I just have to listen. This fantastic music is the music associated with, you might say, the curse, the moment that Carmen realizes that this young soldier is giving her a lot of attention, just watching her, and she throws a flower at him as mockingly, in a mocking manner that he takes very seriously. He keeps... He keeps the flower and has it still with him when he sees her days later and confesses his love to her and showing him the beautiful aria, La fleur que tu m'as jeté, the flower that you threw to me, at me, is still here close to my heart. And that, bah, that's the moment in the opera where she throws the flower and it hits his chest.
Well, I felt like I was there for a second just now.
Well, that's one of the things about this piece, that the music is so perfectly expressive of the emotional moment. It's a quantum leap in French music and French opera particularly, because it's so deeply dramatic. It's almost like a modern soundtrack, this music, a film soundtrack. But as a musician, I mean, and this conductor, this is one of the things that fascinates me most about lyric theater. The fact that if music, they say, is an international language, it says things that words cannot say. Well, what is the function of music when there are words? What the words actually do in an opera is they give you a specific situation about which then the music can elaborate and intensify the message. And this opera is so successful, not only because of the local color of gypsies and Spain and so on, but I think most of all because the music speaks directly to the heart. And the dramatic situations are very realistic. I mean, they're totally believable. These are real people, simple people, or at least not simple emotionally, but these aren't rich kings and queens. These are people encountering real life with dirt under their fingernails and challenged by the grinding poverty of the world they're living in. One of the fun things about the piece, musically, of course, is the really economical way that Bizet manages to give us different sorts of colors, colors of sound. We talk about color in painting, but in music there's tone color. Tone color is produced by the various, huge number of various instruments in an orchestra, and most particularly by how they're combined. Because you put an oboe with a clarinet, and that sound is a different one than just an oboe, just a clarinet. And if you combine, for instance, a solo oboe with a solo violin, it's a beautiful moment in Brahms' First Symphony in the slow movement where the two of them play the same melody. And the sounds blend together to create something else beyond the simple adding of the one-on-one. At any rate, in Carmen, Bizet has an orchestra of the normal size and a brass section. Brass section is trumpets and trombones. The French horns, you know, kind of belong to that group too. But the trumpets and trombones have a very important function when it's big, loud, and festive, the very beginning of the opera with the Toreador March and other moments. Well, in the final scene of the opera, which is in a sense the most dramatic of all, suddenly the trumpets and trombones are not playing. Not at all. We hear the rest of the orchestra while José is threatening Carmen, begging her to return to him and threatening to kill her if she doesn't. The music is very intense, but these instruments are missing. And one wonders, as a conductor at least, when opening the score, this is so dramatic, maybe they should be playing as well. Well, Bizet's got a trick up his sleeve. They will play. They've gone upstairs to go backstage, and they are playing the Toreador music because this scene is happening outside of the arena. While there's a huge bullfight going on inside the arena, these two people alone in the dust are fighting out their relationship where no one sees them because everyone's at the bullfight. So we get this sort of cinematic effect through orchestral sound of there being a big, huge arena full of people because the brass section is up in the back. And of course, the chorus as well, singing Eviva, Eviva, Ole, Ole, backstage. So you have a marvelously 3D effect simply because he sent the trombone and the back with the chorus and upstage. Another advantage, which is more interesting practically, excuse me, than maybe to everyone else, but to me it's fascinating, the intensity of the music is not so loud because the brass are not included, that the voices, the two, the tenor and the José and then the mezzo Carmen, their voices are more prominent. The personal drama is more intense because the big picture, the crowd scene, is off stage.
Now, was Carmen when it premiered? Because I've got several stories. I've read several stories about even Rossini having operas that just, for whatever reason, flopped. They just didn't work. And then a lot of times you read they go back and rework these operas several times and then premiere them 10 years down the road. Was Carmen an instant success?
No, it wasn't a particular success. What's interesting about it also is it was written and not performed at first in the big Paris Opera House. Mm-hmm. It was performed in a smaller theater, and the producer of the theater's wife actually sang the role of Carmen.
Really?
So it was a kind of an inside deal thing. What is really tragic about the story of the composer is that he died very shortly after this work was written. Bizet died, I think he was 35, 36, his middle 30s. When you think of the music that he could have produced if he'd lived longer, it's extraordinary. He wrote great music beforehand, but this is his first serious, really masterwork for the ages. And French music itself suffered a loss when he died so very young. I draw a parallel, actually, between Bizet and Gershwin, because Gershwin died very young as well. And I think American music would have taken very different directions if he had lived a normal lifespan. But at any rate, that's one of our activities. We'll be presenting with the Med-HD at the Academy. We'll be presenting the pre-talks. Next one's March 2nd, Daughter of the Regiment. Another will be in April 14, a week after our Traviata. Looking forward, of course, to Traviata, but a week after that, I'll be speaking about Die Walküre of Wagner. Don't get me started. An hour is not near enough for me to talk about that work. And the last on the season is the Dialogues of the Carmelites, a fascinating, beautiful work about the French Revolution in May 26th. So that's one of our activities. Big thing, of course, is our Traviata production. It is the first fully produced opera in the newly renovated historic theater, the first time opera has been performed there in over half a century, in a space born and built for opera, and that is on April 5th and 7th. Right before that, we have a big party. It's kind of fun, I think, to celebrate before the performance instead of after. We're calling, therefore, the Prelude Gala. It's a prelude to the gala on March 23rd at the Academy in the warehouse. And we are our team, and especially Nora Moore, who is the head of the committee, have come up with some really cool ideas to make this party special. I'm not going to say a word about it, other than whether it's what you drink, what you see, color, what you hear, because there will be some fun music, very fun, are all going to be unique. They're all going to be different than any gala, dinner, fundraiser, that you've ever been to. Now, we all know about that. The politicians call it the rubber chicken circuit, you know? You show up, there's tables of eight, there's somebody speaking about something terribly fascinating while your salad is wilting or your chicken is getting cold or, God forbid, you're not on the front dais and you haven't gotten your food at all. All of that's gone. The minute people come into this party, I can't wait to see this because I'm not telling you what it is. The minute you come into the foyer, to the lobby for your pre-drinks, you are going to be amused, and it's going to be really a fun party. The Prelude Gala on March 23rd, one week or 2 weeks before there, the big balloon goes up.
That's Can people go to this?
Well, yeah, that's why I came all the way to Roanoke to tell you all about it.
Well, then, now you've hope got that, this great big buildup here. Now I got to know. How do I get information about this?
I'll tell you the easiest way is just to give us a call at 434-528-3397. Because we're selling the tickets.
Ah.
And we're actually really sold well already. I mean, if people don't get on this soon, they might not get a seat. I mean, there's only so many people we can squeeze in into the space. The space is going to be gloriously decorated. I'm not saying anymore. It's gonna look good. It's gonna sound good because we have some wonderful music. And as I said, it's gonna taste good. The caterer, the menu is marvelous, but there's even going to be some special libations, especially for this event. Signature cocktails, I think, is the word. I just learned that recently. Not that you have to take that one. We have a full bar, open bar, as part of the price throughout the evening. And, of course, a silent auction and live auction with some great deals. It's a party.
Wow, you got a lot
Who doesn't
going on.
Want a party. Yeah, I'm really excited about this. And because it's placed where it is in time, mm-hmm. While all of our opera stars are in town, then the opera stars will be part of the fun.
Oh, great.
Yeah, they're going to be there to sing a few little. Well, I won't say any more about that.
Well, if somebody, we got a lot of. I talk like, you know, we're still using modems when I talk about computers. We got a lot of people out there that sure like to use that internet, but I'm sure you have Opera on the James, do they have a website?
Absolutely, Yara. We're on the web. Just okay. Google Opera on the James, or it's www.operaonthejames, all written together, .org. And you can get all the specific information. I mean, actually, you know, I don't know what... Somehow it happens I'm doing a lot of speeches because I'm also doing a little preview about the opera performance. It's called Opera Up Close. That'll be on March 17, a week earlier, at 4 o'clock p.m. At our opera building, right diagonal across from the Academy, right next to the Holiday Inn on Main Street, in downtown Lynchburg. And that'll be our very personal sort of pre-talk and insider look at this production, which is historically hugely important. We are a fully professional resident company at the Academy. The Academy has a number of good friends and a number of resident companies. I'll be so bold as to argue that building a theater like the Academy has, because it was built for opera, it was built not for movies. You know, it was built in 1905.
I was just going to ask you that.
Many towns now have renovated theaters from the 1920s that were built in the Hollywood era, Hollywood palaces. They have to be reconstructed to really handle stage performances because they usually have very shallow stage and inadequate backstage facilities because the movies didn't require them. This theater was built in 1905. Its look is 19th century. It's elegant. It is not a garish Hollywood palace. It's also amazingly intimate. I sat and listened to a performance, a wonderful concert that was presented a couple of weeks ago, and I sat in the fifth row, and I could count the hairs on the back of the concertmaster's neck. It is an intimate space. It's more intimate than the average Broadway theater.
Wow.
So,
and I'm guessing the acoustics match.
Yeah. Well, we gave them a good test in December when we gave a couple of performances there. The acoustics are world class. I mean, I don't say that lightly. I've had the privilege. I grew up in Boston. When I was a teenager, I played on the Boston Symphony Hall stage, Symphony Hall stage in Boston, and then went to Juilliard and was in Carnegie Hall every other week. This space reminds me very much of the finer opera houses in Central Europe, which are much smaller than the Metropolitan and similar houses in the United States. So, I mean, there's nothing but good about this. And I'll tell you, personally, I'm terribly thrilled to be involved with the opening and production of opera in a new theater space, because in some of my former jobs in Europe, we happen to be, let's be positive about it, highly challenged by the inadequacy of the theater space we were in.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. In Rostock, where I was most recently, the beautiful old theater that was built around when the Academy was built, when in Germany, it was bombed in the war rather early, and was never properly replaced. They did a provisional rebuild of another space to, you know, sort of tide things over in the 1970s. And when I took over the company in 2004, was it? No, 2008, they were still playing in that space. Now they're finally going to build a new theater. They're just getting going on it. But the political climate or whatever just didn't allow for that at what would have been the normal time. So I spent a good deal of time there seeking out ways to make the provisional situation better. But I, at that point, never dreamed that in my next life, in my next phase of my career, I'd be part of an opera production in a spanking new stage house in a historically, perfectly restored opera house in Lynchburg, Virginia. So...
That's wonderful, and I can appreciate it because I was raised in Orange County, Southern California. About the oldest houses you can find in Southern California around 1920. Because until Hollywood moved from New York, which was where all the films were originally being made, they figured out on the West Coast, guess what? It's sunny practically 24/7.
Right.
So you have this wonderful natural lighting. But there's nowhere to go to see an old... Mm-hmm. Beautiful place mm-hmm. like you're talking about there. So listeners out there all over our broadcast area, just appreciate that you've got some class like that out there.
Yeah, and there are many people who love opera who weren't prepared to go, for instance, to beautiful productions we did in the Warehouse Theater. Now we have a real opera house. And there'll be a lot of people who, I think, will be interested to go just because the space is so elegant, the space is so fine, and there's no better thing to enjoy in a theater of this sort than a grand opera performance. And we have, of course, world-class singers. We have the super titles, so if you're a newbie to opera, you're not going to be wondering what's it all about. And certainly there's no dress code, no dress code at all. I think shirts and shoes are probably a good idea, but otherwise we have no expectations in that department at all. So it's an opera production for everybody. And because we're for everybody, we appeal also to the general public for support. Performing art has never paid for itself. The ticket prices would have to be so high that, you know, very few people could go. So we finance our productions beyond our ticket sales, which are very good, with donations. And we've started, actually the board and the company started before I came on full-time, a marvelous fundraising effort called Turn Up the Lights, which kind of fits with our move into the new theater. And the Turn Up the Lights campaign is a fantastic process for many reasons. First of all, we've already raised, with a goal of $2 million, we've already raised a good $500,000. So we're really excited about really a new phase for Opera on the James, of course, and for our region. The opportunity to really see what music, singing, good theater, gorgeous sets, beautiful costumes. There were going to be period costumes from the original time the piece was written. This kind of spectacle, live, with all good respect to the Metropolitan Opera on their beautiful screen, that's two-dimensional. It's a great learning experience to see operas on the Met screen, to watch them on TV or DVD. There is nothing like the live experience. That's the real deal. That's the real thing. And that's what we're proud to bring when we do Traviata on the stage on April 5 and 7.
And anybody looking for more information can go where?
Fastest way is to check our website, operaonthejames.org. Or you can just do your search machine, Opera on the James, or Opera in Lynchburg, and it'll pop up right fast.
Put it in the Google machine.
There you go. There you go.
We've been speaking with Peter Leonard, principal conductor and interim artistic director for Opera on the James. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.